Hello, readers. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this is Bookin', brought to you by our new presenting sponsor, the North Carolina Book Festival, one of North Carolina's many amazing premier literary events. Happy to host North Carolina's many amazing authors, along with national and international bestsellers, prize winners, independent authors, and debut authors. My guest today is award-winning author Daniel Wallace. His new book is This Isn't Going to End Well, The True Story of a Man I Thought I Knew, which is published by our friends at Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Jason.
It's an honor to have you here. And first, Daniel, before we get into your book, I've missed being in North Carolina. I miss running the North Carolina Book Festival, which you've always been very supportive of, and thank you for that. Besides being a fantastic writer, Daniel, you are also a teacher, and you spent some time recently overseas. Where did you go, and what did you do there?
Last semester, I had the opportunity to teach a group of UNC students in a internship program that UNC has there twice a year, once each semester. UNC happens to own a little flat there where the professor can live and teach classes, where there's a whole support system for these students.
Wow.
And they come and take a bunch of classes related to the UK and London in some way. I taught them some creative nonfiction. And then they do jobs which are something relevant to their careers or potential desires in life, whether it's to be a doctor or a business person or somebody in theater, for instance, and allows the director, me, and his wife, Laura, to explore London at the same time. It's really kind of a dreamy situation.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. What a great program. Thank you, Daniel. I'm glad you had fun. And hopefully you're glad to be back home. Well, now let's jump into this fantastic new book, This Isn't Going to End Well. And I mentioned to you that I picked the book up and found that it was the exact book I was looking for at the time, even though I didn't know it. And Daniel, can you take a moment to set this book up for our listeners and to tell us about your brother-in-law?
Yeah, This Isn't Going to End Well is I think thought of as a memoir. I think of it as a hybrid, really, as a memoir, biography, true crime book that is really about my relationship with an incredible person, my brother-in-law, William Neely, who is a he was an artist, a cartographer, and an adrenaline sports fanatic, who changed the world of whitewater through his drawings. He was a part of my life since I was 12 years old, and became a kind of a mentor of mine without him even knowing that he was. He never volunteered for the position. I never asked him for it, but he was such an attractive personality and so stirringly and it's kind of sensitively masculine and hip and cool that as 12-year-old as I was and sort of a recessed individual that he would become this kind of iconic and a person to whom I was drawn to as this light that I could follow to be a man, you know, and then also to be an artist. He was brave and was brilliant. He could build anything, take anything apart, put it back together. There really wasn't anything that I ever found out that he couldn't do. So he maintained this sort of position of this otherworldly kind of supernatural power. And then in 2001, he took his own life, and that shattered a lot of the belief system that I'd had. And he abandoned my sister, who had rheumatoid arthritis, and so the love and the respect I had for him quickly diminished and became a kind of a hatred. So 10 years after that, my sister died. I found his journals when I was going through her things after her death and read them and discovered this other side of William who nobody knew. And really, that was the impetus for this book, those journals.
Yeah, thank you so much, Daniel. A country, the United States of America, for example, or the world may mark time by an event that happened on a certain day, September 11th, Pearl Harbor, D-Day, JFK's assassination. What we don't hear about so much are these events that change a person's life forever or a family's life forever. And you write that this date, July 19th, 2001, marks the before and after of your family's life. What is it like to have such a clear delineation between a before and after? And can your family and people in general who experience these types of things every day, can we ever move past this type of feeling?
I don't think you can ever move past it, and I don't really know that you want to move past it. You'd learn to live with it, trying to understand it. And in a case like Williams, a suicide so often is a mysterious act. Nobody knows really what the reasoning was behind it. There are not a lot of these so-called suicide notes that people leave behind, and even when there are, they really don't focus on actualities that seem real at the time. So, even though William, for instance, did leave a lot of suicide notes, he left upwards to 25 pages. They still really didn't deal with the matter at hand. So the thing that eats at you as a survivor of suicide is, why did this happen? Why would this person who I loved and who loved me make this ultimate choice to leave us? You generally don't get an answer to that. In many cases, you don't, but the difference between those stories and William's stories is that through reading his journals, thousands of pages of his work, you do get an idea of who he really was on both sides of the coin and why he would have made that decision.
Yeah, thank you for that answer, Daniel. This book came out in 2023. As I mentioned before, we started recording here. You told me about it, I believe, in 2019 or 2020, as you must have been starting to work on it in earnest. This date that we spoke of was in 2001. This is your first memoir, even though it's also, as you said, a true crime book, amongst other things. Can you talk about the 20 plus year process of absorbing an event, your brother-in-law's suicide, wrapping it up with your life story, and then figuring out how to write about it?
Yeah, it's for any book, it's hard to nail down how it happens. How I think just for the ease of conversation, simplicity of talking about it, we say, well, I've been working on this book for 2.5 or 3 years or 10 years, whatever it happens to be. But books aren't really written like that. There's an amount of time that you do spend at the computer, in a chair, typing, taking notes, and that sort of thing. But most books germinate kind of in secret with the writer. And this book has several different stages of construction. And part of the construction of this book is my whole life, because the main character or the protagonist is somebody that I knew since I was 12 years old, and then knew until the day he died, and then have been living with him in one way or another since then. The actual day I can look back to the day that I took all his journals out and started reading them, because I had them for years before I even looked at them, because I didn't want to at first, or I didn't know what I wanted to do with them at first. I knew that once I started looking at them, something would happen. There would be some sort of change in me or in the world that would be important. So I didn't really want to open them until I felt like I was open to that kind of change. So, and I marked it in my journal. I've got a picture of the day that I took all the journals out of their case, as it were, and put them on this desk behind me. And I think it just came up the other day, Jason. It was like almost exactly 8 years ago that I took them out and started this active kind of process. So even though every book has an unknown germination stage and an unknown growth cycle, this one in particular has many, many stages of growth. Like it really is kind of remarkable. It's like no other book that I've ever written in so many different ways, and no other book that I ever will write, for sure. I mean, I can tell you that for sure. There won't be another book like this by me.
Yeah. Thank you, Daniel. And listeners, as Daniel writes in his book, though William's reasons for dying were uniquely his own, the choice he made is all too common. There are resources to help. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. And there's also a three-digit dialing code, 988, that will route callers directly to Lifeline. You can also text 741-741 to be connected with a trained counselor 24 hours a day. If you are thinking of suicide, please know that you are not alone and that you do not need to live alone with your thoughts. There are people who are prepared to help you right now. Please give them a call and stay with us. We love you and we do not want to lose you. Daniel, I've always thought of you not only as a writer and a teacher and a good person, supporter, professional acquaintance and friend, but also as an artist and cartoonist. Is this an art, drawing and cartooning, that you picked up from your brother-in-law? And can you tell us more about his art?
We have William, first and foremost, was an artist and thought of himself as an artist, as a cartoonist particularly. That's how he started his artistic life in high school, the way I think many of us do, who are interested in that sort of thing, doodling. Heavily influenced by Art Crumb at the time, so that was in the the late 60s and 70s, and then from there you kind of hit a wall. I mean, you can't it's if you love drawing, if you love cartooning, the avenues toward supporting yourself in that world are very, very limited. So he kept doing it, but didn't really have an avenue towards supporting himself with it until he discovered that he could use his skills to draw maps of this other thing that he loved, which is rivers, and to show people how to navigate those rivers in canoes and kayaks. So I grew up with him drawing these cartoons, then doing the maps, and then doing more cartoons at the same time. He never stopped doing cartoons, and that ex self-expression and seeing him follow his dream and try to create a life out of so a support a life in which he could make some money and put some food on the table doing what he loved, is, I think, the determining factor that took me from one potential path in my life to this other one. I think artists and people who are ambitious to do something like art, whatever kind of art it is, it's very helpful to have a mentor, even if that mentor is you don't sign on to anything. Obviously, there's no mentor paperwork. You just have to see somebody doing something that you want to do and realize it's possible. And parenthetically, just living here in Chapel Hill, it's great for a writer, to live here, because you can go to the grocery store and you can see a famous writer buying, broccoli and doing, dropping their purse on the ground and everything falling out of it, and just people being human, right? All around you. And I think we definitely, if you're like me, you put writers on a pedestal especially when you're growing up. But to see people actually being human and realize that we're all that way, we're all human, and we can all do this, and seeing people live, is there these like these temporary mentors that you can have and experience. So William was like that for me, and I definitely did start drawing, or feel like I had the license to draw because of what he did. And I never have, and I've never done anything in the approaches the world of his abilities, and what he was able to do. I just do what I do, which is really like one step up from doodling on a napkin while you're waiting for your coffee at a diner.
Well, don't sell yourself short, Daniel. Thank you for that answer. Listeners, we're going to pause here for a word from Libro FM Audiobooks, and then I will be right back with Daniel Wallace. The Bookin' Podcast is sponsored by Libro FM Audiobooks. Libro FM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore, Quail Ridge Books. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know the name. But you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. Listeners of Bookin' can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of one. Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter Bookin', Bookin, in the promo code space. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores. I'm back with Daniel Wallace, author of This Isn't Going to End Well, which is published by our friends at Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Daniel, I have always thought of you as a North Carolina author with a capital NCA, but I've learned over the years that Alabama claims you as well. How do you identify, and can you tell us the difference between living in Alabama and North Carolina?
So I was born in Alabama. I lived there for 18 years before going to school in Emory University, Atlanta, and then transferring up to UNC. And other than a couple of years, I've lived in North Carolina my entire life. So my entire adult life. So that's like 40 years. And yet, I have not written a novel that is set in North Carolina. All of my books are set in sort of fictional renditions of Alabama, even if Alabama is not mentioned. That is, the topography and geography of Alabama is in my mind when I'm creating my stories. And that's not on purpose, really. It's just this identification that I think people have, or at least I have, with the place that I grew up learning and knowing. I still feel like I know Alabama better than I know North Carolina, which doesn't make any sense. I still feel like, although North Carolina is my home, and by, in any way that you can measure it, it's the place where I've been the most in my life, psychically, physically, but probably not imaginatively. I don't get inspired by thinking of specific North Carolina related moments of my life. And it's an imprinting thing that happens, that the Alabama's where all the firsts in my life happened. After that, everything was second, third, or fourth. So So I'm a North Carolina writer. All of my books have been written here. Many of my books have been published through Algonquin Books here. I mean, I straddle these two states. There is a kind of a feeling of being transitive or being I still feel like that I've only recently moved to North Carolina, and can you show me around kind of feeling. And I don't know how to explain that. I don't know if other people have that sense of things, but it's definitely a different living here is different than it would be were I to ever move back to Alabama, which I'd never want to do. I don't, I'm not aching to return. I love it here. I mean, I love the life that I have here in Chapel Hill. This is more than anything that I ever could have expected or hoped for. It's great. And I love it. You know, it's got its own issues as everybody everywhere has, but it's weird. It's complicated. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for that answer, Daniel. You went to private school around middle school age, I believe. You graduated from college in, I cannot recall the exact year right now, but it was either 2006 or 2008. So it seems you were a non-traditional student in at least a couple of different ways. Can you tell us a bit about your journey through the educational system, where you eventually landed as an instructor at the University of North Carolina?
Yeah, well, it would. It wasn't traditional. I did go through a traditional high school experience and graduated in, I can't remember, 77, I guess. I took a gap year after that, and then went to Emory, as I mentioned. And when William and Holly is my sister and his wife, when they moved to Chapel Hill, I visited them up here and wanted really to live with them. I wanted to live in the same place they lived. And so, without visiting the campus, without talking to anybody, I just applied to UNC and got in and started going to school here. It turned out that UNC was much different from the school that I was leaving behind, Emory, which is a small private school. UNC was a really big public school. I got kind of lost in the transfer portal feeling of that everybody had already situated themselves in their world, and I was coming in the back door, and I was really more interested in hanging out with Holly and William than I was being at school. So when I got to the end of my senior year, I realized, oh, I don't have the credits to graduate. That is, I'd been taking classes, the full load, but I wasn't taking the right classes in order to graduate when I thought I would. And I decided that I wouldn't go to the trouble, that nothing that I wanted to do in life necessitated a college degree. And the two things were either A, work for my family business, my father's business, or become a writer, which I'd always played with this idea romantically of being a writer. So I was right, for the first 20, for the first 20 or 30 years after not graduating from college, I didn't need a degree. I did decide to become a writer, did start eventually just publish when I was 40, is when I published my first book. So I was writing for 15 years. Just doing odd jobs, doing selling some of my cartooning, that sort of thing. Many income streams to keep me treading water. And then, but finally, I was ready to settle down in a way and teach writing full time at North Carolina. That's what I decided. I thought that would be the best path for me. So I went to the university and asked them if I could do that. They were very into the idea and offered me a job, but that necessitated me to getting to get a degree from college. You can't teach college unless you have a degree from college. That's one of those fancy rules that you don't maybe don't know. So, but what was great is that they allowed me to go back to school and to get the classes that I needed. One was applied mathematics, the other was cellular biology. And once I did those two classes, I got the job. And so I graduated in 2008.
Nice. That's a great story. Thank you so much, Daniel. I now want to ask you about a quote from your book, which is, "Part of growing up is pretending not to care about the things you care about quite a lot," end quote. Can you unpack this quote for our listeners?
Part of my evolution as a man was learning how to hide my feelings initially before I was able to share them with other people. But I do think that quote refers to the this idea of cool, what it means to be cool. Certainly sharing your emotions, your tender side or your enthusiasm for certain things is frowned upon, or I felt as though it were. And I think that in fact, what is interesting about that is that what I learned much later, decades later, reading William's journals, is that he was, in fact, almost a professional at showing one William and experiencing at the same time another William, which we didn't see, we didn't know. And he set his whole, even his physical life, he set up to curtain himself off from the world. He always wore sunglasses. He had really long hair that fell into his eyes. His part of his face was curtained, and he's very quiet, but also, an actor and so benevolent, but not a person who was going to, say things that ended in exclamation points.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Daniel. Can you now tell us about cutting your teeth on The Moviegoer by Walker Percy and conversely, James Joyce's Ulysses? My father-in-law, who I met when I was a child but never really knew as he passed away before my wife and I started dating, was a literature professor first at Delta State University in Mississippi and then Winthrop University in South Carolina, and the authors he focused his work on were Milton and Walker Percy. So this question holds a lot of interest for my family.
Excuse me. Books hit us at the sometimes at the exact right time. There's it's like meeting somebody at the exact right time of your life that can change your life. It can change the way that you think about the world, about and about fiction, if you want to be a writer. And The Moviegoer by Walker Percy was one of those books that fell into my orbit when I was starting to imagine what it might be like to create an entire fictional world and how that would happen. So, and I'm going to say this is when I'm, maybe 18 or 19 years old, this particular experience. And Walker Percy is from Birmingham. He was born here. He's actually claimed by Louisiana, I think. But you do whatever you can. You use whatever light that you can. And certainly, I was more than willing to think of him as leaving his shining kind of literary fairy dust around my town. But something about that story, something about the tone of the story, the narrator being Spaulding was spoke to me, and became kind of a totem for me. I carried that book around a lot and read it a lot, and actually I actually stole from it a lot when I was starting my writing my first stories and learning how to write. And they say writers, good writers borrow, great writers steal. And I took that really literally, and I lifted sentences from the book, maybe changing them a little bit. But it was, if for some reason a story of mine like that had ever gotten out into the world, obviously they were born dead on arrival. But if it had, I mean, I stole so much, I would have, could have been sued, and but that's not a bad thing. I don't, for a writer to do, when they're learning, I don't think. So, I, it's a book that I carried around in my back pocket for a while and had different editions of it, and of course read a lot of his philosophy and too his some of his nonfiction, Message in a Bottle, which I loved. Later on, I took a class at Emory, that was taught by Dr. Rushi, and I've been trying to find him for years and years. I've never found him again. I don't think he stayed at Emory, but he taught this class on Paradise Lost. And during the class, all we did was read Paradise Lost. And in every class, we went over it line by line. And that was transformative for me. I still have my copy, obviously. I mean, I would never give up that copy of Paradise Lost. Something about that is so personal. I mean, the book, the poem feels personal and hugely mythic and universal at the same time. So those two books are very important to me, that experience of reading that Paradise Lost with an incredibly brilliant professor, immensely important. But to get to the second half of this, the James Joyce Ulysses book, I realized that if I wanted to become a writer, I needed to read that book. I needed to not only read it, but learn it, to know it. And one summer when I was living at a lake house, that my a little lake cabin, shack, I guess, more like it, that my grandparents had owned, I took modern library edition of Ulysses, and then a book, exegesis of Ulysses, which explained chapter by chapter what was going on in the chapter of Ulysses that you read. So I would read a chapter of Ulysses, and then I would not understand it at all, and then I'd go back to the book that I brought to explain what I'd read to me. And the process I discovered, I learned a lot about myself, is that I'm not an intellectual. I don't have what it takes to work to understand something that I'm essentially not interested in. That is, I'm interested in the application of the experience of being part of a work of art, the way that I was with Paradise Lost, the way that I was on my own with The Moviegoer, but did not have whatever that extra filament is, the extra chromosome that takes me to whatever level, whatever place that is that I am going, wherein I'm going to spend my time reading something to tell me what I just read. And so I got to about page 272, I think, of Ulysses, And two or three chapters into the book explaining Ulysses to me, and I decided, I'm not going to do it. And I haven't read another page of Ulysses ever since. And I try to keep my books at some point, page number below 272, 277, whatever it was, just so because I feel like maybe that's the length that all my books need to be.
There you go.
Maybe that's why I stopped.
Understood. I like James Joyce. I had a great professor that led me through Ulysses, but when I was a graduate student, I did a directed reading with my friend, the poet Tom Lisk, may he rest in peace, and we spent a whole semester in his office reading Finnegan's Wake out loud to one another
Whoa.
with Joseph Campbell's Skeleton Key to Finnegan's Wake. And I'm still
Wow.
not sure either of us understand it, but
I
it was fun to read it out loud for sure.
don't, you know, and I think things could have gone so much. I could be telling a completely different story now if I'd had that professor, for instance.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah, professors are important. Well, finally, and listeners, I cannot recommend this book to you highly enough. I've written in the newspaper, the Colorado Sun, which ought to be published by the time this interview airs, that this book will undoubtedly be one of the best books I read this year. It came out last year. The paperback comes out this year. Maybe one of the best books I read this decade. But Daniel, my last question for you is, how did your family react to this book, both as you were writing it and after it was published? Were they supportive, scared, some combination of the two, or other feelings? And how did you feel when you finished it? Was it a cathartic process?
I think what you said is exactly right. They were supportive and scared. I was the only person who read the journals. Nobody else in my family read the journals. We were going to throw them all away. When we found them, my sisters were there, my wife was there, and we decided that there was no real reason to read them, and that it wasn't our business to do it. But I kept them. Unbeknownst to them, I kept them and eventually read them. So, when you're a writer, and you know somebody, and feel like because you're a writer, you can write about that person, I feel like that's true, but everybody else who knows you can do the same thing if they want to. And everybody else who knows you has their own perspective and experiences with you. And I think my family, who by this time was two people, my sisters, they had their own relationship with Holly and William. So they were scared that I would usurp these people by writing kind of a defining. Well, I mean, the only book about them, which kind of defines them for the rest of the world. Jason, for you, for instance, since you didn't know them, these are the only Holly and William that you know, or the re most readers will have. But people who did also know them could read the book and say, well, this is not exactly the Holly and William I knew, which is absolutely true. So they were a little bit scared of how I would depict them on the page. And some of my early drafts, or one draft, which I thought might be the close to the final draft, I did share with one of my sisters, and she didn't love it, but still she was supportive. I went back to the drawing board a bit and changed the book around, not based on what she says specifically, but for a number of reasons. And the final version, once it was done, she ended up loving it. She really did. And you could tell the difference. My little sister also felt the same way. I think that the people who knew Holly and William, and who also a third character who we haven't talked about because it's a little bit, I mean, it gets too deep into some of the heart of the book, but Edgar Hitchcock, who was a friend, best friend of Holly and William, who was murdered tell his story as well. And his family really appreciated it. And all the family members I've heard from my own family, William's family, Edgar's family, have all really enjoyed the book and feel like it's an important book for their families, that these stories be told. If anybody hasn't liked it, they haven't or objected to it, they haven't gotten in touch with me about it. The process of writing it, for me, I guess, cathartic is one way of, I think that's the go-to word here, but it was transformative to this. It's like being, reintroduced to somebody you thought you knew intimately, and all the experiences that you had with him, with William, everything, the life that I lived with him was true. There was nothing about it that was a lie. He wasn't pretending to be anybody else. He just was more complicated than anybody else knew. So it wasn't that he had a shadow life that was the truth, and his superficial life was the fake one. They were both real. He was equally real on both sides of the coin. And it's transformative to learn something like that about somebody else. So I don't, again, this is for me, was that it came together finally to become the book that it did is for me is so it makes me so happy and makes me content that I was actually able to get it to that point where it's a document that is readable by somebody else, and it's not just some emotional wailing of somebody feverishly typing at the computer. It has it has moved people. People get in touch with me all the time because it is does touch on a lot of two common areas in our lives, that suicide is so prevalent, so much more prevalent, I think, than people know. I mean, it's remarkable. It's millions of people consider it too, and don't do it. So it's really a pandemic, and so I feel like in that way as well, William's story becomes transcendent and universal and can actually do something practical and good in the world. So I'm very happy about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for mentioning Edgar's story in death is when your book takes a turn, when William's life takes a turn, result everyone else's lives eventually take a turn. And thank you, Daniel, for writing this wonderful book. I think that you're right on. It has the potential to help a lot of people, and I believe it already has, and it will continue to do so. Listeners, I've been speaking with Daniel Wallace, author of This Isn't Going to End Well, which is published by our friends at Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Daniel, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Jason. Talk soon.
Once again, I would like to thank Daniel Wallace for joining me. Copies of This Isn't Going to End Well can be purchased from your favorite local independent bookstore. I would also like to thank our sponsor, Libro FM Audiobooks. Please navigate over to Libro.fm and enter the promo code BOOKIN, that's BOOKIN, in the promo code space to get one free audiobook and support your favorite local independent bookstore in the process. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this has been Bookin'.